This is a quote from the statue herself. It says, "Keep ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free." So we've got some pretty good documentary evidence as to the reason for understanding, caring, being interested in the poor. But now let me ask you a personal question. How many of you have ever described yourselves as poor, have felt that you were poor?
Brought back in the depression.
Exactly. Right. Well, I'm glad to see some people have. Well, let me push it just one step further. How about your parents or your grandparents?
Oh, yeah.
Sure, there are more of them. Right. And we don't, we're kind of bragging about that, aren't we? I am. You know, I came from poor but honest stock. My parents had to work hard, and their parents even harder, and all this kind of thing. So that poverty really has a kind of status. Seems to me that the people I know who came from rich stock are a little uncomfortable about it. You sort of have to explain how come you're not richer then, or something. But most of us really did come from at least some degree of poverty. How many of you have ever been on welfare? Or let me let you off the hook. If you had been, do you think you'd admit it?
Oh yeah.
Could we
want to define welfare? You mean
yeah. Could you rephrase the question into how many have been on welfare to how many have been welfare recipients?
Okay. How many have been welfare recipients?
Well, me.
No,
that's it. Yeah. Well.
Now, John.
Right.
Point.
Right.
So
that.
You said, "What do you mean?"
What do you mean by welfare?
Mean?
Right. How many of you have been the recipient of a program designed to help citizens financed by tax dollars?
Family.
Hmm.
Family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would include that education too.
Yeah, I would too. I would too, Gunner. Right.
Yeah. How many of us have been to public schools? Financed by the taxpayers?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
How many of us have been hiking out in the wilderness forest?
Well, how many of us are veterans who are entitled to really good
stuff?
Oh, well,
we veterans earned our... No, but how many people from the poverty-stricken areas of the country, the rural poverty that we've seen, the urban ghetto poverty we've seen, are able to take advantage of the wilderness area up here? So it's a kind of funny welfare benefit, isn't it?
See, what has happened is that we've gotten accustomed to the idea, I'm not knocking it, I think it's all right, that the government should do more and more and more for some of us, but we're a little dubious about the government doing more for some of the rest of us. Now, why is that? What's our problem there? How come we think it's all right to have FHA loans and GI benefits and certainly public school, certainly the highways, for heaven's sake, who's going to build the highways if the government doesn't? But those things we pay for, darn tootin' we do. And yet we're a little dubious about whether the federal government should be in the business of whatever you want to say, maintaining income, keeping citizens alive, I don't know what you want to call it. Yeah.
We think some of those people are sort of freeloaders, and we have work to get out.
Right. I think that there is certainly some of that feeling in all of us. So what's the difference whether you freeload one way or the other way? Now, I have at home, unfortunately, not here, a list of 20 welfare myths, and it's really good, all the things that we all know about those welfare people, you know, about how they chisel, about how it runs in the family, about how, especially about how there are all these really good welfare deals for able-bodied people who ought to be working. Well, in my state, I don't know about Washington, in my state, there is no welfare for any able-bodied male. Now, there is a little something for females if she's got children and can show that she actually has to stay home with them, grudgingly. You know, we'd really rather she went out and worked all day and then came home and took care of her kids, and then we'd fuss because she didn't take care of her kids right. But that's neither here nor there. We do, though, kind of feel that somehow this sort of thing should be done by something other than our taxes. Right? See, I've got some words on the board. And they have different connotations, although they all kind of mean the same thing. Poverty, pauper, indigent, poor. That's about the same thing, but we have different feelings about it. We also have different feelings about the things we do to try to ameliorate these problems. And the first one that I put down is charity, because it's the oldest one. Now, what do you think about charity? Like, do you think that's a good way to describe charity? What do you think charity is?
Should begin at home.
Okay, right. That's a good one. Yeah.
Well, I work for a charitable hospital.
Yeah.
And our charitable commitment is to anyone who has need, who does not possess the ability to pay. And that's our definition of charity at that particular point, and we would provide that.
okay. So,
hand over here.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah.
Charity to me is more of a one-time operation, whereas welfare would be over an extended period. If their house burned down, we'd have charity and we'd help them through that immediate crisis. But as far as long-term payment on the house, that's something
uh-huh.
else.
Uh-huh.
The word benevolent comes to mind. Either that it's the church or whoever's doing it, sort of benevolent giving.
Right. I'm up here, you're down here. Yeah. I'm going to give you something out of the goodness of my heart.
Also, it seems to me charity is unpredictable. That with welfare, you can predict. You say, I earn so-and-so, or don't earn so-and-so, and I get so much. With charity, it's you might get help and you might not. You can't
depend on that. That's a very good point, and I'm going to get back to that. Right.
I think if you look at charity and welfare, charity is usually privately provided. Welfare is usually state provided or government provided, and that's how you define the two differences. That makes charity more unpredictable because it depends upon
right, right. And what happened, you see, during the Great Depression, the charities, which had been doing at least a reasonable job with taking care of these needs, these one-time needs or these long-term needs. You know, for goodness sake, once you get old, you can't say, well, I'm going to straighten you out and tomorrow you'll be young again. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. You know, you're going to keep on needing that charity. But what happened was that the charities themselves, all these good voluntary organizations, were finding that their funds were drying up. You know, the people who used to be given charity were finding that they needed it at home. And so there simply was not enough to go around. So in 1935, for the very first time in all of history, the United States got into the business of, quote, charity. And we call it the Social Security Act. So Social Security Act has a long, horrendous history. Some people were really thinking about that very seriously as early as 1910, 1915. But it didn't come into being until this really dramatic depression hit not just a few pockets in the United States, but the whole country. There were people all over the country who had to have some kind of help, had to have it quick. Well, I don't need to go into all of this, but what happened was that the Social Security, philosophy of the Social Security was to give some aid to all those unemployed people who had never been unemployed before. They didn't know what to make of unemployment. It was just a completely new idea for them to be paupers or poor or indigent. They hadn't been before. They didn't know how to cope with this. You know, this is, we're going on the assumption that surely if you're poor, well, you've always been poor and you sort of get used to it, right? Yeah. Well, but what gave the Social Security Act the impetus was that a whole bunch of people who hadn't normally been poor all of a sudden were. However, by the time the act was passed, it was so watered down, so done and redone, so affected by various lobbies that very, very few of the original intended recipients, were able to get Social Security at the time. Now, what the Social Security did, and this was really good politics. I don't want you to think that there was something ideological that had nothing to do with politics about the Social Security Act. Uh-uh. What happened was that certain groups were able to make quite an impact. Anybody know who gets what from the Social Security? Well, I'm looking around at what I assume are some of the favored recipients.
Well, I'm retired, but mine wasn't based on Social Security.
Okay, but that was the idea. Yeah, what?
I thought it was educational benefits for dependents.
Okay, right, for dependents. And they
That's
could
fairly
be,
recent, yes.
Yeah, okay, but that is certainly one of them. What, do anybody know what were the two basic tenets of the Social Security to begin with?
Widows benefits.
Okay, there was it was an insurance thing, for widows and survivors, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody? Did you know?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well.
Okay.
But also, the strong out for the people reaching age 65, and a serious question comes: were Social Security benefits provided for people over 65? As a way of taking care of them, or as a way of getting them out of the job market so that younger people could have their jobs?
That was certainly a consideration.
For those of us who have forgotten, during the Depression, the unemployment level reached somewhere around 30%. It may have been as high as 33%. Maybe a little under 30, a little hard to tell. But it's something for us to bear in mind when we're talking about that period. We think it's bad, most of us think it's bad to have 6% unemployed today. That's twice the percentage we used to regard as normal. So we think 6% is bad, but in those days we're talking about roughly 30% of the labor force unemployed. The labor force is made up almost entirely of men. So we're talking very largely now about breadwinners for families, roughly one-third of them out of work, looking for work. So that to suck the over 65s out of the job market, take them off the job market, was to create vacancies for some of those unemployed younger people.
Right. The insurance, the old age insurance, was one big section of Social Security. And as you probably know, there was a lot of discussion about whether it was legal, was it constitutional, for employers to withhold certain amounts, which had to be then returned, then matched and returned. But great numbers of jobs, of occupations, were not covered by that original Social Security. And again, it depended largely on who lobbied for what, with the result that farm workers, certainly housewives, clergy people, a whole bunch of them didn't get covered because they didn't know the right people. But the other half of the Social Security was the actual effort by the United States government to get involved in the business of welfare. And as I said, it was originally hoped that would be much more global, much more far-reaching. But what it ended up with was that there were certain categories of people who would be covered by government funds, matching funds with the state. It was a rather complicated arrangement worked out, so that the states had considerable control over how much was given, how it was given, what were the eligibility requirements, all those things. But the groups that were covered are, to me, kind of interesting. There was an old age assistance. Now, that was for old people who obviously had not been covered by the Social Security, regular Social Security insurance. They were people who were old and poor. That was one category. Another category was aid to dependent children. There'd been, previous to that time, there'd been quite a lot of concern about what do we do for children in this society. And the 30s was just the beginning of some effort to take care of children in their own homes. This was a pretty revolutionary idea. Previous to that, we had thought, if the family can't take care of the kids, pull them out. Put them in foster homes, put them in orphanages. There were various things that you could do. And then gradually the idea began to be pretty prevalent, at least in social work circles, that maybe the best place for kids is in their homes, and maybe it's cheaper to keep them in their homes too. Good idea. So the aid to dependent children was a real conscious effort to make it possible for indigent families to keep their children at home, to give them actual cash money. Oh, that's another thing that's pretty revolutionary about the Social Security Act. Before that time, the various charitable institutions had worked out various arrangements for giving people relief either in cash or in kind. You know what kind is? Right, things, materials, clothing, food, whatever it is you need. Now, what do you suppose was the rationale for that? Why would they prefer to give relief in kind than in cash?
Probably not get them in the habit
of spending money.
Yeah, make sure they get what you want to give them, that they don't go out and spend the money on booze.
Foolishly, right?
They wouldn't
right.
drink it all up.
I beg your pardon?
They wouldn't drink it all up.
Right, right, exactly. You're absolutely right. Now, what does that say, though? What does that say about our consciousness of the kind of people who need relief in kind? What kind of people are they? They're not people like us, by darn. Nobody better tell me how to spend my money, right?
Right.
So what this charity in kind meant, again, was a kind of benevolence, a kind of kindly, I'm going to give you this, and you better be pretty grateful too. So, the government, the federal government's efforts, had nothing to do with kind. There was going to be no giving in kind. It was going to be cash. You were going to get your check once a month, and it would be mailed to you. It was going to be as dignified a process. This was the philosophy. This was the thought. As dignified a process as could be managed. So then we had old age assistance, aid to dependent children, and another group. I don't know if anybody knows what the other group was in the original Social Security. Aid to the blind. Now, isn't that interesting? Why the blind? Certainly, lots of blind people need aid. But why they any more than the deaf or the handicapped or the mentally ill or retarded or a whole slew of people like categories, if we were going to have categories. So why do you suppose why the blind? Why'd they get it?
Had a good lobby. Yeah.
Right. See, you know, blindness is something that we can all see and be sympathetic with and toward, and we can understand that blind people need special help. It's not too hard to talk people into aid to the blind. And blindness has been one of the ailments that hasn't been ever very embarrassing, like mental illness. See, you'd have had a hard time getting a special category for the mentally ill. You know, most people at that time were really pretty embarrassed about that. It showed something wrong with your genes or whatever.
Character.
Yeah, character, right. Or, you know, all kinds of things. So anyway, there were those three categories. Well, the Social Security Act, then, was a really a giant step forward for this country. And yet, those backward countries of Europe, like England, Germany, France, Sweden, I'm sure Norway, although I don't know that much about Norway, had such arrangements years and years and years before. Now, have you any ideas why? Why would the United States have been so slow? Or conversely, if you don't like the idea of the Social Security, why did we give in at that point? Anybody got an idea?
I think a lot of people thought it represented socialism.
Well, that's true. That's true. You know, socialism is creeping socialism, right?
That's not enough of an answer, though. That's a symptom of an answer. Because why were other government programs not called socialism?
Yeah, you in the back.
I think that it might have something to do with the fact we always wanted to see ourselves as a land of opportunity. So you don't want to admit that you have poor people who can't make it, but then when it gets to the point where you recognize you've got 30% of the people who aren't making it, we got to do something about it so that that becomes less obvious. Otherwise,
right.
We have to admit
right.
that our ethic of opportunity isn't holding up too well.
I think that's a really good telling point, because see, we did take over some of the other kinds of European ideas. We did take over, for instance, the poor farm, the county home, that kind of thing. Because what does that do with the poor? That puts them out there where the rest of us don't have to see them, don't have to think about them, don't have to look at them. And as long as you've got a manageable number, you can do that. So we didn't mind borrowing from Europe on that. But to actually admit that we had a nationwide problem that could not be handled by any other agency, apparently, except the federal government, was rather difficult. Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that at all. So we had this Social Security Act, and it kind of muddled along as best it could. One of the strengths as well as one of the weaknesses was that it gave the individual states a great deal of leeway. What was done in Mississippi was not done in New York, and every state could make their own rules and regulations and would get a certain percentage from the federal government no matter what they did, and then would get more if they added more benefits. Well, a lot of states felt that they could not afford the extra benefits, so they got the bare minimum. But everybody got something from the federal government. So this was quite a turnaround. There were a lot of people hired to administer the Social Security Act, a lot of workers hired to work with families. It was a great shot in the arm for the profession of social work, I assure you, whether you liked it or not. Okay, so on the face of it, it would have seemed that we had a pretty good arrangement back in 1935. It seemed that way. Well, now think of today's welfare arrangement as far as you know about it. What's your perception of what goes on in welfare today? Anybody? I know some of you know something about it.
Yeah. In the 30s, they had WPA and various programs like that where the people actually had to work for their money. It was government-provided jobs, but they worked for their money. Now they don't work for their money.
Well, you're right about that. And the WPA, I think, was an excellent program, but it was a rather small program. Mm-hmm. It didn't begin to cover the numbers of people who were being taken care of. And certainly, see, this is really interesting. For the most part, children were not involved in WPA. For the most part, the blind weren't. For the most part, the old age pensioners weren't. This was a different program, right?
Mm-hmm. But there are employment programs right now where, for at least short periods of time, people do work for whatever welfare grant they get, depending on which state you're in. So it's not.
But that's small too, isn't it?
That still isn't the people she's talking about.
It's not the children. It's not the aged. Right. And it's not the blind. Right.
There was a youth program. Some of my buddies whose mothers were widows, they had they made $22 a month working at office jobs and things during the WPA's
CCC.
No, there was a youth program, right? In addition to CCC.
Yeah.
You know, you asked us if we had received welfare ever, and I was just thinking, I don't know of anybody that receives welfare. I mean, none of my friends, and I wonder how many other people here that know somebody.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm a pharmacist, and we fill what we call welfare prescriptions, so we know lots of people.
Oh, you know. Are they your friends, though? I mean.
Oh, no, well. Not my enemies. I don't
believe
that. No, not necessarily. That's a joke.
I told you.
Couldn't resist that. No, not in our strata of society. I don't think we know.
Yes.
You asked what our perception of the current welfare operation.
Right.
As far as, I mean, it's. I believe that even now, the majority of people who are on what you call welfare or public assistance are still the same people that it started out for. Aged dependent children, handicapped people who cannot work.
Yeah, the handicapped have been added
right,
as another
yeah,
category.
Yeah, it's beyond blind. It's people who cannot, and that, the and aged, that part of the people who cannot work are still, by far, the majority of the recipients of welfare. And the able-bodied male who's sitting there drinking beer or whatever and collecting welfare is really not very common, I don't believe.
Well, it's practically unheard of.
The opposite of that though, is something that I've heard that families have been broken up over the ADC thing, that you can't get ADC as long as there's a man there, so the way you take care of it is the man leaves.
Yeah,
but that depends on which state you're looking
right.
at.
Right. Right.
That's
right.
not in this state.
Our daughter was involved in the CETA program this summer for 8 weeks. And that would be a type of youth employment. On the basis of her handicap, she has a severe learning disability.
Uh-huh.
And I felt really bad part of the time because of the inefficiency in which these jobs were handled. A young man was sent up. And he actually had 1 week in order to set this whole thing up for, we come from just a little town, there are about 60 jobs available for 80 some youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
She's 19. And many of those kids spent their first few days totally just idle on their jobs. Some of the employers hadn't even been contacted, yet they sent kids out there to work for them. And it was just terribly inefficient, and I thought, oh, such a waste, but it was because I guess poor planning. And
well, what you see, those it's like a lot of other things in the bureaucracy. You apply for a grant, you don't know at the last minute whether you get it
yeah.
or not, and then when you get it, you've got to get cracking quick
mm-hmm.
because it's only going to last for a certain
mm-hmm.
length of time. I grant you that there's inefficiency.
Mm-hmm.
I think where we get confused is when we blame the recipients for the inefficiency of the organization. And we do that over and over and over again. We do that. There's a good book out called Blaming the Victim. And it makes that very point. Yeah. Did you have something?
I was going to say that I work for the state of Washington and I work with welfare people. Not all of us are inefficient, so.
Good, I'm glad you said that.
We have a heart for some of us state employees. And also, you mentioned the unemployable male is practically unheard of. I would like to.
No, I don't say he's practically unheard of. I said for him to get a welfare check.
Oh, not necessarily true. Not anymore, I don't think. I work with a number of them who are receiving, who I would consider employable. If you want to get into the definition of employable male or employable head of household, you could probably spend several hours doing
right.
that.
Right.
So probably that would get off of what you're saying here.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So, necessarily.
But certainly in some states like ours, there is no such program. There's nothing
no
for an able-bodied man who's just lazy.
Paul, that's Florida, isn't it?
Right, mm-hmm. And I think it's typical of a large part of the South and a large number of the rural.
But that's a mindset. That's a mindset that someone who is unemployed is lazy if they're, you know.
Yeah, yeah. See that, and really, you're exactly right. And that's what I'm trying to get around to is what is this mindset we have about that last category down there, the deserving and undeserving poor.
Yeah. Let me add to the mindset.
Okay.
Several places that I've spoken, I've talked about the folks that I meet in terms of the welfare system. And I remember a woman who was a cashier at one of our supermarkets in Minneapolis who said, you know, that trouble with these people that are welfare, they come to the store with their food stamps and they buy TV dinners and Doritos and stuff like that, and, you know, they would just buy the good stuff. And I said to this woman, you know, you're probably looking at one of the biggest junk food junkies around. And nobody tells me when I come to the store and I spend my money if I buy Doritos and Kool-Aid and ice cream and stuff. But the mindset is that these folks, these persons that were welfare recipients, you know, should not be buying the stuff that a lot of us like.
Right?
Well, John,
why?
The rationale for that is that we're doing it with our money and they're doing it with our money.
But see, you know, your money and my money, in terms of paying for the highways, and also for the welfare, for the well-being of other human beings.
May I tell you something else?
Wait just a second. We have a participant up here.
The thing is that all you need is two or three food stamp recipients to buy the Doritos and
the
TV dinners, and that means that they all do it, and you could have the majority of the rest of the population buying it, and that's fine.
I had a student who did a study on that very thing, and the managers of the supermarkets told her, without question, that food stamp people always bought all these crazy things. So she did a little study, and she would watch them first of the month when they had their food stamps. Oh, what they were buying was the most cheap, simple kind of food that you could buy. You know, milk powder and flour and beans and rice and so on and so forth. You know, she documented it. That isn't going to convince anybody. But
the U.S. Department of Agriculture did a survey, and I think it was 78, and it was saying that compared to the rest of the population, the diets are very similar, but the only difference, I mean, where the difference is that the food stamp recipients are more economical. It's slight, but they are. And that's one of the surveys that I read just this last
year. Yeah.
Well, I had an experience with a fellow who worked on my beach place. I got him from the Salvation Army. And I think the wages at that time was $3 an hour, which is very low. He was a truck driver, and I think everybody here knows that a truck driver can make $20,000 to $25,000 a year.
I didn't know that.
But he was on welfare. He was on Medicaid. The government was paying part of his rent. His children were being taken care of without cost, and he was receiving food stamps because he only worked enough to be in that category. That's all he worked. The rest of the time he worked for the Salvation Army, and of course he didn't report that.
Maybe he was
that's an actual
driver.
Case. And he opened right up and told me the whole story.
Okay. See, I'm not trying to say that there are not cases like that. There have to be cases like that. This is a big country. There are a lot of people. But let me ask you this. How come do you suppose the rest of us aren't doing that if it's such a great deal?
Because it isn't a great deal.
Well, because we have some pride, that's why.
Well, I'd hate to think that was the only reason.
Well, it's one of the big reasons.
But let's push that point, because we could get to a very fundamental point, I think. If we have these poor people, and the reason they're poor is just a failure of their ability, that's a criticism of the economic system. But if we have people who are poor out of moral defects, lack of pride, lack of conscience. That's the criticism of our society at a much more profound level than economics. That's a criticism of our education of each other. That's a criticism of our so-called Christian caring, loving responsibility for each other. It's bad enough if we bring up people who aren't able to work. It's much worse if we're bringing up fellow Americans who are so defective in their personal character that they don't want to work. Happily, all over the world, it runs the other way. The overwhelming majority of people, everywhere in the world, prefer to work. In this country, at this terrible time with this high unemployment, we still have today something like 94% of the labor force employed. And that other 6% is going to be employed very soon. There's very, very few Americans who draw their chisel, who draw their goof off, be lazy, not work. Overwhelmingly, I'm not talking about 51%, I'm talking about 90-some percent, 90-high-some percent prefer to work. That's the rule. Why are so many middle-class Americans uptight about the minuscule minority that we hear these horror stories about? Why do we characterize our unemployment programs as though that's what everybody's trying to get in on? Now, there are food stamp chisels, but there are more Americans entitled to food stamps who don't get them. Either they don't know they're eligible, or they're so hassled by the bureaucrats, I'm not talking about now big state level bureaucrats, I'm talking about that lowest level of frontline bureaucrat, like me, the direct service. You know, I'm in direct contact with my clients, the recipients of my social service. At that level, these people get hassled. They come in to get food stamps, and Betty can tell you some horror stories about that. That's much more common than the chiseler.
I think it's the invasion of privacy that drives a lot of people off, because by the time you report every little thing about your family,
that's part of it. But I've had students go to get food stamps. Now, these are bright, intelligent young people. They're entitled to food stamps for various reasons. They don't have enough money. First they have to make an appointment. Oh, 6 weeks in advance. What are they supposed to do in the meantime? Too bad. Sorry. So they get the appointment, and they arrive, and the person in charge says, did you bring your tuition receipt? Did you bring your rent receipt? Well, no, I didn't know that. Well, you'll have to go back and get it, and then make another appointment for some other time. You know, really, if you could figure out any way to avoid it, you wouldn't do that. And as I say, these people have their stuff together. They're not already beaten down and humiliated and have no self-confidence before they ever start. What's it do to somebody who really, really is in a bind?
So maybe what you're saying is that most of us aren't really we don't object to welfare for the people who need it, but we object to the kind of system that you have to use to get it to those people. And I don't personally, that's what I object to, is the system that people have to go through. And I have that daily experience of having to deal with that, and I think it's a lousy system. But somehow, how do we deal with it?
Yeah, well, you know, if anybody's got some good ideas for, you know, cutting the red tape and all that sort of thing.
Let me give you an example. We have a Vietnamese family that our church just adopted and brought over in the Boat People program, or whatever the new program is called. And we found them in a condominium to live in our community for $395 a month. We wanted to go and see what they're eligible for from the state and from the federal government. And in order for them to get a housing subsidy, they had to move out of the $395 a month condominium into a $780 a month house, because the federal regulations say they have to have so many square feet for a house and so many bedrooms for the number of people. And the Vietnamese don't want to live that way. You know, so the government's willing to pay $780 a month. Our congregation's willing to pay $395 a month. And we've got to take them out of one program, and, you know, it's just why? And get the rules that way. And that's the kind of welfare thing that bothers me, and I think bothers a lot of people. I don't mind the Vietnamese entitled to that if that's what we're doing, but the system is just blowing the cost guy out. Anybody else feel that way? Mm-hmm. You have any experience?
Well, I have a sixplex in Watsonville, and the federal government came up with a good program for once. They gave cheap money to slumlords like me to fix up places, to make them nicer. It really didn't make me any more money. If I sold the place, I'd come out even, but it would be nicer for the people while they were living there. And I thought, geez, that's a great deal, good idea. Well, they gave it to the bureaucrats in Watsonville. I'm an ex-bureaucrat, too. And they said, because they wanted to eliminate some of the people from downtown, even though they were all good liberal Democrats, they wanted to get rid of some of the people from downtown. They said, well, the federal regulations say you're going to have to reduce it from a sixplex to a fourplex because two of those are substandard. Yeah. And I said, well, where are these guys going to live? I suggested to them that it was better to live in a substandard place than out in the street. But they didn't understand that.
No.
And finally they said, well, we have no legal liabilities. You can kick them out. So I got out of the program. Now that was a, I know the gal, I know she thinks she's really for the poor, in my case, really for the Mexicans. She just said, well, they're going to have to go. And, you know, that's the kind of, it is so silly. I mean, it was, the feds thought of a really good deal, and it really would have worked, but then it got into the hands of the guys that had their secret agenda.
Oh, okay, you know, I quite understand that, and I quite understand the problems with the system, but sort of what we thought we were going to start talking about tonight was the difference between poor, deserving, and undeserving. See, and I think we're getting a little off this because we don't seem to be talking about the poor. And I'm wondering whether you are feeling that there are some people who are deserving of help, however the system manages to give it to them, and some others who are not. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it exactly addresses that question, but it's a feeling that I have, and maybe other people probably won't, I don't know, won't, isn't probably very popular, but I feel like I would rather have my tax dollars pay for a system, a humane welfare system, so that people are not suffering and not starving, and old people are not eating dog food, and children are not going hungry. And so what if a few undeserving poor collect a little? I'd rather they did and make sure everyone gets what they need. I don't mind carrying the he didn't like that. Sorry. If there are undeserving poor out there, I'll pay. Just to make sure that people get what they need.
That isn't a national feeling.
Would you say that it's a Christian feeling? You said it's not a national feeling.
I agree.
It's not a national feeling. I wonder if it's a Christian feeling.
I would think so. I would like to think it was.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
I think
the big reason that I think everybody feels the same as she does, that people who are deserving of welfare should have it, and that they should live like human beings. But I think generally that the country as a whole is not only misinformed on welfare, but they also are aware of the bureaucracy that's been built up, not only for welfare, but for Medicare, for instance. Social Security, for instance, where a third of the total of the money that goes for Social Security is used in administration. What's ridiculous is $130 billion, 1978, and $40 billion of it was used to administer mm-hmm. the program. Well, I think that's what people are really
okay. Well, if that's what you want to talk about, I wanted to find out who these undeserving poor are, but maybe we'll get to that in a while.
Well,
do you know who they are?
Let's say if I quit my job and decided I'd go for the welfare thing, would you say I was deserving? You're the professional.
Yeah. See, I got a lot of question about that. Why is it you're going to quit your job?
Well, say I didn't want to work. I'm just a...
Yeah, well, why don't you want to work? See,
I'm
so many really unstable, unbalanced, mixed up, confused, psychotic, neurotic, you name it. I can just list you a whole slew of those people who quit their jobs because they don't want to work. And to me, it's not just a question of why don't you want to work? See, as Paul said, the overwhelming majority of us want to work. So what is it about you, mister? Why don't you
work? I don't want to work. I don't enjoy, working's a drag to me. The
okay.
only reason I work is to get paid.
Yeah, right. Well, see, I'm really curious about that. But why is that?
Well, I don't know, but there's a whole lot of
them
just like me where I'm working.
Just do
Let me ask you to do something with these two different kinds of people, the deserving and the undeserving. If you're going to rank order people from best to worst, who goes on the bottom?
Well, I'm not ranking.
No, but if you
which
could.
Is the worst case? The person who's physically unable to work, or the person who just has something in their head that says, I'd rather freeload?
The person that's unable to work.
Is worse off.
Yeah, I should think they would get extra consideration.
I didn't ask that question. I asked which you have the lower opinion of. Lower down on a scale of respect.
Well, yeah, the guy that refuses to work, that's able.
Now, tell me, would it be fair for me to say that in our society, such a person would be the least of our brothers?
Well, I can tell you what the Bible says about it.
Yeah. We can all tell each other what Jesus said to do to the least of these.
Thessalonians, it says no working, no eating.
That's right.
that's not what Jesus said.
That's what it says in Scripture, and that's the same thing.
Amen.
In Thessalonians.
I think it's very, very difficult to get around. I was hungry and you fed me. And even if you've done it under the least of these, my brethren, you've done it under me. And I think we're getting close to the end, and Betty wants to tell us a little bit about St. Botolph's Church in London, where they're dealing with the least of our brothers.
This is a program run by the Church of England. St. Botolph's is a very old church in East London. It's St. Botolph's Aldgate. That means it's at the old gate of the old city of London. And St. Botolph was the British patron of travelers. People prayed at the church before they went on a journey and hopefully prayed and gave thanks when they got back from a journey. So it's been around for a long time, 15-something or other. The current rector has a program for working with the people who live in his parish. The people who live in his parish are down and out. They normally sleep in doorways rough. The British say rough. They sleep rough. Doorways, if they can find a doorway, or out on the street or wherever. They're a pretty shocking lot. A lot of them are middle-aged, although they look old. I mean old. They haven't led nice lives at all. They have drunk too much, eaten too little, worked too little, been sick too often, had no dental care, on and on and on. Everything you can think of that could be wrong with people is wrong with these guys. Mostly guys. No, not all. Some are women. And so he says sometimes the women give the most trouble. I have to add that because of my position. What he does is run a refuge in the crypt of the church. And I liked it because the crypt is indeed a crypt. I mean, it's one of these old-timey low ceiling with the arches and all. And it's where, in the olden days, they used to put the bodies. That's where you buried people in the old days. And our friend said, well, When he came along, he decided that the crypt would be better used for the living than the dead. So he cleared out the bodies. The bodies didn't care by that time, I'm sure. And he serves an evening meal. There's a place where they can wash up. There are some counselors around it for anybody who wants counseling. But the point of this program is that this is not going to be a nice success story. Most of these guys are not going to be rehabilitated. They're not going to go find a job. They're not going to get straightened out. They've been in this mold for a long time. They're losers. That's what they are. Now, when you stop to think about it, you think it's better for St. Botolph to leave these people sleeping in the rough? Many of them freeze to death in the winter, of course. Or do you think it's better for St. Botolph to make this effort to do something for these guys who aren't gonna straighten out?
I have lost.
Me too.
Let me ask one question.
Yeah.
Is that charity or welfare?
You're talking about private charity. They aren't interested in getting color TVs and everything else.
Well, I think they'd be interested if they thought they had half a chance.
Well, let's hear it for St. Botolph.